MNK Talk YA now presents Illuminae, Part 2, from the Illuminae Files by Amy Kaufman and Jay Kristoff. Welcome back to MNK Talk YA.
I'm Marissa Snyder.
And I'm Katie Bradford.
And this is our podcast where we talk all about our favorite YA fiction.
And this week we finished the Illuminae Files book one, the whole book, called Illuminae.
The whole book by Jay Kristoff and Amy Kaufman.
Yeah, our first co-authored series, but we talked about that some last week. But it's really cool. I still love that that's how the series is written.
Me too. And I am really glad because we had a really quick turnaround between recording sessions. So we like recorded our last episode on Monday and it's only Thursday. And so we had to read half a book in about 2 days.
And Marissa edited our episode and got it all, like, we made our deadline on Wednesday to post and everything. Yeah. So it has been
a quick turnaround. It's been a little crazy.
All hands on desk.
Yeah. Or
all hands on deck.
All personnel braced for impact.
Yeah, we were really getting into the spirit.
I felt like happening. Katie when I was just like frantically trying to edit, like, you know, like I was copying code or something or trying to hack into a computer. It really got me going. But I was glad because we left off at the most brutal cliffhanger ever. And so I was kind of happy that, like, I had an excuse to kind of tear through the rest of it. But then you texted me the day after we recorded, like, on Tuesday, and you were like, I'm already done with the book. You read it in, like, less than 24 hours.
Yeah. Well, I read some that night because I didn't have to edit. I think you probably started editing right after we got off, and I started reading. And then my work is just, my Excel is really slow, and I'm doing a lot of reporting, and the way the chapters are so short, I was reading a couple of pages or whatever while Excel, like, calculated for 15 minutes, and then I'd do some more work, and then it would calculate again, and I'd read a couple more pages. So it went quick for me.
It is easy to be like, just one more page, because, yeah, you just fly through them.
And there were actually a lot of pages that didn't have a lot of words in the second half.
Yeah, I liked the ones where the text was in a swooping pattern. It was kind of set, like, against the galaxy. And it was doing that when they were attacking Lincoln. And then when Katie was doing the spacewalk. And it was kind of cool because, like, the shapes were almost like how you would imagine a plane to be flying. Or, like, someone who was walking against the side of a spaceship. It was in the same pattern. I thought that was really cool.
So was that, like, Aiden's interpretation of what was going on? Was that supposed to represent that?
That's a good question. I have no idea. That's a really good theory, though.
Because I agree. I like the visual. It kind of, especially since so much of it is just reading documents and text, it was cool to get some of the visual elements of it, too. But at least when Katie was on the side of the spaceship and stuff, I feel like he was narrating, sort of, or thinking, or whatever the proper term is for a machine. And I think same with the other one you were talking about with the space
when Ezra
swooping.
Was flying, yeah.
Yeah.
Well... But yeah, cool. Yeah, that's actually that's a cool idea.
So, okay, so we left off. We seemed for impact. We survived.
We survived!
But then some crazy stuff went down. So we kind of knew Aiden wasn't ready to come back online, but we had no choice, so we brought him back. And he was not very happy about what had happened to him.
Oh, no. That was actually, like, okay, my first impressions of Aiden were... One, he talks very poetically for a machine. Is that mean to say?
No, I mean, I would agree, because you think it's all, like, logic, but, and even, you know, he doesn't get certain humor or other kind of emotional things, so it's kind of interesting that he is so poetic, but it felt like he was stealing things from other places. It didn't feel like...
He was,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, so that kind of made sense still. He just, like, had all this information and would kind of randomly try to pull things.
I liked when he kept quoting Gladiator. Like, he kept saying, am I not merciful? Am I not merciful? I say that at work a lot. I don't think anyone gets the reference.
I, of course, haven't seen that movie either, so I've probably missed half of his references in this.
I almost feel like he's an extreme narcissist because he has these huge delusions of grandeur, and he's talking about how all humans are insane and is making fun of Katie because she only has an IQ of 147. But it's interesting because he does have a sense of his own self, you know? Like, he really did not want to be taken offline again. He was almost like had an instinct to fight for his own survival, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, except I have a couple of questions about that.
Okay.
One, I'm curious how much of this is because something in his code or hardware was damaged in the attack versus how much of this is just kind of like natural AI progression of, you know, realizing self and whatnot. And then the other question I had was, at first, I think even as we're kind of interacting with him, he develops more and more of a sense of self and a sense of, you know, relationship with Katie and, you know, kind of grows in that way. But at the beginning, I also wondered how much of he really believed that if he was shut down, he could not protect them and he needed to be able to protect. Like, maybe if his instinct really was, I have to save as many of these humans as possible, I can't do that if I'm shut down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it brought me, I know we talked a little bit about this last week, but so we used to play like Moral Dilemma when growing up, where
World Dilemma?
Yeah, you'd be given like an impossible choice and you'd have to pick which one you would do.
Oh, okay. Oh, are we going to play it?
Yeah, I have a couple for you.
Yes. I like that we're playing games.
So the first one I think I talked about last time a little bit, but so say there is a train coming down the tracks and you see five people who are tied to the tracks or for whatever reason are going to be killed by the train that's coming. If the only way you could save them was if you pushed a button, the train would go to a different track, but if it went to the other track, there'd be one person there who would die. Would you do nothing, like not get involved and watch those five people die, or would you push the button causing the death of one person but saving the lives of five other people?
Oh gosh, because in one case you're just kind of a bystander, in the other case you have agency in it.
Yeah.
Well, I guess Aiden would press the button because his whole drive is like to protect.
Probability, yeah.
And he like brought up that he almost brought up that exact scenario that you were talking about, because he did mention at some point killing a handful of people to save, or killing one person to save the greater population would be the right decision to make. And he, you know, talks about how like he can mimic love, he can mimic compassion, but he is just mimicking it, he doesn't feel it, and it allows him to make hard decisions.
Mm-hmm.
That he had that whole portion where he was talking to Katie about that. So, I mean, Aiden would definitely push that button. Me?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But Aiden, that was a funny thing about Aiden, because he also would admit that he couldn't really understand why humans would do something, you know, why they would make certain decisions or act a certain way, because it was illogical or emotional. But he still would make decisions based off of probability that, you know, but I still like sort of don't understand how releasing those diseased people onto the rest of the ship, even though he was trying. I mean, I understand that he was like, oh, they'll kill Commander
David Torrance,
and the coder guy. I can't remember anyone's name right now.
Oh, Byron.
Yes, Byron and David Torrance. But wouldn't he also realize that then the airborne disease would be all over the ship? And
would it affect the other people?
Doesn't he have so many other options for either containing or killing Byron and David Torrance? To me, that felt like, if you've really analyzed every possible situation, is that really the best choice that you could come up with?
That's a good point. And it did feel almost a little bit like revenge. Like, he almost was getting emotions in the way, you know? Like, he knew they were trying to shut him down. But at the same time, I don't know. It seems, as angry as it was for being shut down the first time, I was like, oh, this seems vengeful to me.
Yeah. And I didn't even know if it was like, it was almost weird that he was asking, like, what are your last words? And let me play music that I know you find calming as you die.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know.
But he also admitted that he asked David if he had any last words for his wife and children, not because he cares, but because he doesn't want David to think that he doesn't care.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he says, which is such an important distinction to make. He doesn't care, but he doesn't want to give the impression that he doesn't
care. I mean, he would be a sociopath if he were a human.
Yeah, because he's so good at mimicking
a lot of what
human
they're
emotion.
Saying is,
Okay, so are we going back to this scenario?
Oh, yeah. Or I can give you another one. I don't know. There's not like a right or wrong answer. It's just putting you into a situation where it's not
there's no
black
right
and
answer.
White, you know? Yeah.
Okay.
And then like sort of that one escalates then. Like if some people would say, okay, I would push the button.
Do I know any of the people on the track?
Let's say no. But then
God.
The escalation.
Okay, I would push the button. Okay. I said that and I hated myself.
What if instead of pushing a button to switch it to the other track, what you could do is push someone in front of the train?
No.
Which would stop the train and save five people. It's essentially the same thing. No. One person dies instead of five and you're the one who...
No, that's not the same thing, because remember that experiment with the shocks? The Milgram experiment.
Wait, I don't know if I do know this one. That name is so familiar. Didn't he do a lot of things?
Yeah. So it was the, he was studying the ability of humans to fully obey instructions and to see how far they would go to obey authority, even if they were doing something that they knew was wrong. So like in the experiment, he had fake people, or he had people pretend to scream when delivering electric shock. So there was a person who had to answer a series of questions, and anytime they got the question wrong, he would instruct someone on the other side to push a button that would give them a shock. He, like, just one person was in charge of giving these fake shocks, and the other person was, like, instructed to scream. And it started out, like, very mild shocks, and then they instructed them to, like, turn up the voltage little by little until, like, they were delivering shocks that they knew would kill someone. And they, and so many of the people, even though they expressed reluctance to do it, but they still did it. And it was like a study on how humans are programmed to obey authority. So where do we start with this? Oh, so.
So you wouldn't push someone in front of a train.
Pushing someone in front of a train is like, you're so close to that. If you're just pushing a button, you're removed. To me, that's completely different. Because it would be easier, and they prove it's easier to, like, sit behind a screen, not see the person, and just push a button, and they die, rather than...
if you were, like, whipping someone.
Whipping someone?
I don't know. I was just thinking about something where you're physically doing it.
Yeah, like, physically shocking someone, or, like, physically pushing someone in front of a train. Isn't that why so many people... or, like, why poison was really common back in the day? Because it was, like... you could be removed from it, and you didn't have to be up close and personal to get it done.
Well, I mean, that's why that little girl poisoned her mom's smoothie or whatever, but... I also think poison you could just get away with better, because you are less likely to get caught. But I agree. I agree with everything you're saying. But I think if you look at it purely from a logical, or even, like, a set of these are things that I find acceptable or unacceptable, there isn't that much of a difference between pushing a button and... pushing someone in front of the train, except that we all feel like that's a huge step up in terms of badness.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of interesting to think about, like, in these moral dilemmas.
Was there another one?
Okay. So your family is vacationing alone on a private stretch of beach with no lifeguard. You have a daughter and a niece that you're with. They're really close, really want to go in the water at the beach, and they're only 7 years old. You tell them to wait, but they go in anyways, and you soon hear... them screaming because they're caught in a really strong current. You're the only swimmer strong enough to save them, but you can only save one at a time. Your niece is a poor swimmer and likely won't make it much longer, but your daughter is a stronger swimmer but only has a 50% chance of holding on long enough for you to come back for her. Who do you save first?
Well, okay, if you're in the midst of trying to save someone, you're not going to be able to, like, quickly go through that and be like, she has a 50% chance. Like, it would just be instinct. I would absolutely try and save them both and probably drown trying. But there's no way. We would all die. That's the scenario, how that would end. We would just all die. Because there's no way I would leave a child in the middle of the ocean and be like, hey, I'll be right back. There's a 50-50 chance you won't be here when I do. But, like, no, I could never do that.
Okay. I mean, that's what all these moral dilemmas are. Okay, you're an EMT on the scene of a car crash that involves your spouse and the lover you didn't know they had. They're both gravely injured. Your spouse's injuries are worse, and you can tell that it's unlikely that they'll pull through. However, their lover has a neck wound that will be fatal if pressure isn't applied soon. Do you work on your spouse, even though they cheated and probably won't pull through? Or do you work on the lover, who can definitely be saved even though you hate them and whatnot?
Isn't there a law where you're not allowed to do medical work on your own family member?
I mean, I think...
I'm, like, trying to find a way around answering.
I think that if you're an EMT and you're on the scene of a crime, or on the scene of an accident, and your family member is dying, they won't be like, oh, well, sorry, we gotta wait for someone else to come.
That's true. Do no harm.
I think technically your job, I mean, there probably are, probably like, guidelines. I
would
probably have
to. Yeah, I'm sure they would force me to work on the other woman.
Okay, what about this one? This one might be more, okay. This is the last one, just because we could do this for hours, but we used to, like, do this before bed with my cousins. We'd, like, escalate, and we'd all try and come up with our own moral
dilemmas. It's all just me trying to find my way around answering any of them.
Well, I mean, that's how, it's just, it's funny to think about. Like, that's why they're so interesting, I think, because we don't want it to be a hard, simple choice, or we want to justify it, because it's hard for us to say, I would let this person die, or I would make this choice without either justifying it or trying to find a workaround or whatever.
Because, we don't want to have to make these choices.
Okay, so you're involved in a two-car crash on your way to work. You accidentally hit and kill a pedestrian.
Oh, that's like my worst nightmare.
When you get out of the car, there's a woman there who is convinced that she was the one who hit and killed the pedestrian. You're not really sure why she thinks that, but you know it was you.
I would totally let her take the blame. I did. You didn't even have to finish that. I was like, yeah.
Okay. Oh, I didn't realize. They actually tell me percentage of people who pick each thing. Only 24% of people would let the woman take the blame.
What? How many people?
24% of people.
Oh, shit. I'm in the minority of people who are sociopaths.
Let's see. 61% of people would save the niece first.
Whoa.
And
over their own child?
59% would work on the lover, not the spouse.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, also,
do you think people are just saying this?
I was going to say, like, also, people might be saying what they think is like a more morally superior thing. Or who, I mean, I'm sure this cater, whoever, wherever this is being advertised, you know, whatever. It could be a bunch of people who don't have kids and don't really know what they're saying. Or of really annoying kids that day, and I don't know. Anyways, that was kind of fun.
That was so fun.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about Aiden, though, as opposed to his view of moral probability differing from humans, is what did you think of him, like, catfishing Katie?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. So I was shocked. That was such a great twist when he was like, Ezra has been dead this entire time. The person you were talking to was me. Yeah. And I loved it so much that I kind of wished that the end of the book hadn't happened the way it was, where we find out that Ezra's actually still alive. Mm-hmm. And I know they did that because it's a trilogy and, like, you know, the main character can't die in the first book. But I almost wish that the book was a standalone book just so it could have that twist and ends with him actually dying.
Well, yeah, and I'm kind of surprised because she was on the other ship long enough. How did she not check that he wasn't in the survivors of the... I know he wasn't in the officer aircraft. He was in, like, the civilian aircraft because he was injured or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I still don't see how she didn't, with all of her hacking, like, verify that he wasn't on the survivor list.
Because when she first gets to Alexander, I thought she was going to look for him. But then I was like, oh, of course she would go look for her mom first. Mm-hmm. But then after that, I felt the same way. I was like, I would have thought that she would go and look for him immediately.
No, but I mean, because he had already safely gotten home. I mean, not home. He had already safely gotten to Hypatia before she even left. So I'm just confused.
She probably just didn't have time.
Yeah, I just feel like that would be the first thing I would do. I guess if you get a note from your boyfriend saying I'm still on the other boat,
have no reason to doubt him.
Yeah. Except that his artwork improved dramatically.
Drastically. That was so funny. And also it was like, I liked how you could have picked up on it if you had just thought a little bit. Like, when she ends up killing that man, and it was his friend, and she was like, I just killed him. And he was just like, well, where's the gun? Like, why don't you have the gun? Like, that's the only thing he was focused on. He, like, didn't care that she had just killed his friend. And that is so unlike him. And so I was like, oh, shoot, I should have seen that coming. Because he really wasn't acting like Ezra normally does. He's acting like a robot who's just concerned with survival.
Or even the not wanting to talk about their first date or whatever the memory she was trying to bring up when she was, yeah. I did notice that the artwork was significantly more complicated. I did not think that it was really Aiden. But I did note, I was like, wow, he really improved all of a sudden. I did like think that when we saw that. I feel like it's one of those things where I wouldn't have been able to tell you that it had happened, but I also didn't get why he was going into the server room. There were other things that like weren't quite lining up that I was like, something else is going on. I don't know what it is, but I didn't think it was Aiden.
What a crafty, tricky little robot.
Oh, so I read this, or I read random stuff that like shows up on my Facebook all the time, or on...
Oh, me too.
Whatever. So I read this article today about hat fishing. Have you heard about this?
No.
So I guess like there's this thing, it's called hat fishing now. And if you're like online dating and you're looking at people's profiles, especially for guys, if they're wearing a lot of hats to hide their baldness, it's called hat fishing.
That's so great.
I just like skimmed it. I mean, I didn't read like the article. I just read the little blurb, but I was like, that is so funny. But that I mean, people amazing. Make so many snap judgments based off of pictures. I don't really blame them.
No, me either.
But it's also, yeah, funny and unfortunate. Okay, and kind of to your point, sorry, jumping around a lot, but
go for it.
Saying you sort of wish Ezra hadn't been secretly alive on the other ship, I sort of kind of wish Katie hadn't been saved, too.
I know.
Like, I'm glad, don't get me wrong, but it did sort of bring, like, there was sort of this, like, epicness to the ending, and then it sort of was like, oh, but don't worry, everything's okay. That felt a little bit.
I absolutely agree, because I love the idea of her and Aiden kind of having this moment together where he starts thinking about death, and he starts thinking, like, I don't want this to end. I don't want anything to happen to her. And, like, when you said before, he was starting to kind of get a little bit more compassionate, and he started having that feeling, like, you know, where at first he was like, well, I'm immortal. I can be rebuilt, and I'll be exactly how I was. And Katie was like, but will you? Like, you won't have the same... Will you be the same if you're rebooted? And he starts to have these, like, fears of death. And then...
Like an identity crisis.
And then she goes through kind of the same thing. And I liked that they both ended up being friends at the end. And they both worked together. And it was the exact same scenario where it was, like, kill one to save many. Where it came full circle. And it would have been... Like, I don't get me wrong. I'm with you. I'm glad that she survived. But like I said, I almost wish it had been one book, one standalone book, where she didn't make it out and they ended up perishing together, but they saved everyone.
Yeah.
Or maybe something happens and there's, like, a little bit of his chip left over or something that they find, you know? Mm-hmm. So because he said he recorded... Everything that happened so she could tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
So really, essentially, and she has that little piece of him, so he
can... Yeah, it would have been kind of cool if, like, they had both died, and, like, 5 years later, they just found this chip, and that's where it, like, took off, or found the device, and that's where it took off. But I am glad they're alive. I didn't really want them to die. It just felt, you know me, I kind of always want it to be, like, a sad ending, but...
Well, I liked it so much, too, because this week I researched famous last stands in history.
Oh, yeah. Tell me some of them.
Because I was the same way. Like, I loved the idea of, like, we're going down, but we are going down swinging, and we are going to try and save as many people as we can, and we're going to die trying.
And I respected Katie throughout the whole thing so much. Like, her being like, okay, first and foremost, we're getting all the people we can out of here. And then just, like, never giving up the whole time.
Oh, my God,
time.
That scene when she was trying to get everyone out off the ship, and she was, I think it was Winifred McCall who she was with, and she's just, all she can do is, like, try and direct them away from the infected, and it said, I think there were 1,097 and only 659 survived, and she's just, like, watching them all die and just, like, screaming at them through the microphone, like, you'd feel so helpless.
Yeah. And how many were there to start with? I mean, like...
1,097.
But that was after a bunch had already been infected and dead.
I mean, that's true.
How many did we leave the planet with?
I don't remember. Originally? They did have the... they had those countdowns where it was, like, 3% of personnel...
And then going all wackadoo.
Yeah. And, like, the death toll was rising.
I also... I loved that even when Byron was infected, he was still, like, there enough to try to go against Aiden, even though ultimately we needed it. You know, Aiden ended up kind of being our friend at that point. He definitely wasn't, and I think Byron was sort of in the right. And then even his ability to, it was so sad.
That was awful.
But to make that choice essentially for Katie instead of...
Well, I think he killed himself because he didn't want to hurt her.
Exactly. I mean, so, because really she needed to kill him because he was already dying or dead. But since she couldn't do it and he had like a moment of lucidity and realized whatever... He, like, essentially made that choice for her and killed himself to protect her.
Which is exactly what James McNulty did. Yeah. Because she finds out, she finds that recording that he did of his last moments. And he, and like, just how tragic that he shot himself because he wanted to die as himself. You know, he didn't want to go, to be someone else at the end. Or contribute in any way to hurting anyone else. And it was just like, oh, that crushed me.
I agree.
And they were creepy when they, like, came up to her.
And they were like, don't look at me.
Yeah, and how they couldn't hear. Or when they were in that the vacuum and there was no sound and they were shooting at her. And then they were, like, talking over the microphone and still, like, stalking her. Like, it was just, it was pretty creepy. I don't know what I would want to see in a movie because I think the whole movie would freak me out.
Well, it would be like The Walking Dead meets The Martian.
And I can't watch The Walking Dead. I don't know, maybe I could, I haven't tried.
It's pretty good. But yeah, like that moment when she thinks Byron's okay and then he says, don't look at me, I was like, oh no, he's infected. That was like such an awful, awful moment.
Yeah.
Although I kind of suspected that he was gonna die.
Yeah. And I guess I should be glad, not glad, but you know, at least not everybody survived. I always think that's too happy of an ending. So even though it's still kind of crazy that Ezra and Katie made it out, ultimately, we lost a lot of good people.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many infected at the end.
Yeah.
And like, oh, that was crazy too, whenever she's trying to escape and they have the idea of replaying their loved ones' voices to them, because she had, you know, because she was talking to Byron, even though he was infected, she was like, it's me, it's Katie. And she was able to get through to him for like a split second. And that's when he kind of got his sanity back and was like, oh my god, I need to do something so I don't hurt her. And that moment was just so awful when they use all the sound bites of their family members to, like, shock the infected. And it, like, bewilders them and it gives them time to escape.
Yeah, I mean, that was hard, but they needed to do something.
But yeah, I mean, the final scene when she's, like, has to launch the missiles manually because they can't get the automatic system to work. And she's... And they really think that this might be their last moments. I just loved that kind of theme. So I did a lot of research about, well, not a lot, but I looked up a couple cool stories of like people who had a very heroic last stand.
Ooh, tell me more.
So, okay, here's what I found. So this is on crack.com. And I have to say, this article was hilarious. It was making me laugh so hard just the way this guy was writing. I can't say all of it because there were a lot of swear words, but it was so funny. Okay, the first one is Aegeus III of Sparta in 331 BCE. So this is not the 300 story, because I was like, everyone knows that. The Battle of Thermopylae, King Leonidas, like, that's been done before. So I was like, okay, I want to look for some different ones. Okay, in this story, Aegeus III was the king of Sparta, and Alexander the Great, who was the king of the Greek kingdom of Macedonia, was off, like, fighting in Persia or something. And so Aegeus III decided that he was going to try and, like, launch a revolt against the Macedonian troops. And he was going to invade Crete.
As one does.
When the emperor is away. So he was, like, going to rally some soldiers and invade Crete and, like, push towards Athens. So when Alexander got wind that this was happening, he sent his toughest general and an army of 40,000 men to engage the Spartans. And there was a huge face-off outside of the city of Megalopolis, which is a great city name. It was one of the largest battles ever fought between Greek armies in the classical age. And it was really vastly not equal because Aegeus had about 20,000 men and Alexander sent 40,000, so they were outnumbered 2-1. But Aegeus was like, screw it, I'm going to charge them anyway. So he ran headlong into the battle screaming profanities, and he was injured so badly that the troops were certain he was dead. And they were like, we have to retreat. He's absolutely dead. So they put him on his shield and they started carrying him from the field. But then the author wrote, remembering that he was a shit-wrecking king, he got up off the shield and ordered his army to retreat. And so he jumped off his shield and he was like, you go on, I'll stay behind and buy you some time. So I guess he sent his army away to retreat, and he was going to hold off these like 40,000 men by himself. And he couldn't even stand because that's how badly injured he was. So he knelt on the battlefield. And as people ran towards him, he just started like hamstringing them one by one, like slicing the backs of their legs so they couldn't run. And he took down so many people that the opposing army actually backed off because nobody wanted to go near him. And then finally someone launched a javelin, which eventually killed him.
It's crazy what some of these people come up with as like, I'm just going to do this by myself right now, or this is an effective way to fight battle.
Yeah. Or the guy who brought the Claymore sword into battle during World War II, the crazy Scotsman. I mean, listen, it's a time of war. Who knows what's going down? So, okay, the other one, this is kind of interesting. So in 69 AD, Emperor Galba of the Roman Emperor, it was time for him to choose his successor. And one of his advisors told a man named Marcus Otho that he would be appointed. So he was like, listen, I have some details for you. The inside scoop is that you're going to be named the successor. And then at the last minute, the emperor chose another man.
You can't just do that.
Oh, I know, betrayed. And as a result, the man who wasn't chosen, Otho, he decided to assassinate the emperor and seize power. What he did was he rallied 1,000 Roman soldiers who were willing to turn on their own emperor. And he waited for a day when Emperor Galba and his new successor were going to be paraded through the city. And so they were on like being carried on these litters throughout the city. And they attacked. And during the attack, the emperor had his bodyguards with him. And there was one bodyguard who was, his name was Sempronius Densus. He was like a centurion. So he was like an officer of the Roman army. He was like this grizzled old war veteran. And he saw this was happening. And whenever these 1,000 soldiers attacked, all the other bodyguards either ran and fled, or they turned traitor and were helping with the assassination. Except this one man, Sempronius, and he didn't even know the emperor. Like, they had nothing to do with each other. He was shown no favor, but he just knew, like, his job title required him to protect the emperor, and he was like, I'm not turning traitor. This is my job. My job is to protect the emperor. Even though no one else is doing their job, I'm going to do it. So he faced this crowd of 1,000 mutinous Roman soldiers, and he pulled out a cudgel. That's the weapon that he had. He just had like a stick, essentially. And he just screamed at them to stop. And of course they didn't. They just were like, okay, you're one person. Step aside. So then he pulled out a dagger. So not even like a long sword, a short sword. And he fought the entire army by himself to defend a king he barely knew. So he, apparently records say that he fought for quite some time before he was brought down by a cut to the back of his knees and he was murdered by the mob. But during this time, this is the worst part. So the people who were carrying the emperor's litter or carriage, they were witnessing this one man just going to town against these soldiers, and they were so frightened that they dropped the king's carriage, and the emperor like fell out of the carriage onto his face in the middle of the mob, and the mob attacked him and killed him. So it was just like, I mean, maybe he was a terrible emperor, but I just thought it was like a really interesting story, and he was just how brave he was. Like, I really admired the loyalty of that story, where it was just like one soldier was going to attack this crowd of people just because that was what he was trained to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's brave, but isn't it also kind of like I don't know. I think even if I wanted...
a little misguided, maybe.
Even if I wanted to be that loyal, like, I kind of feel like I would do more damage than good in most situations, and then in that situation, I wouldn't do that much good either. Like, they shouldn't probably give me a sword in general.
No, for sure. I would just have the cudgel. They'd be like, here's a stick of wood. That's all the damage you can do.
Here, you can look like you're holding a sword, and you can Photoshop it in the picture. But...
don't fall on it.
I mean, that is very loyal. I just can't imagine being loyal to someone that I had no connection to at all either, even if it was my job. Like, as much as I care about doing a good job, I don't know. I don't know if that's my thing.
Yeah, or just, like, seeing everyone run the opposite direction and you're just like, no, no. It would be so tempting just to, like, run away with everyone.
Yeah, it's easy to follow the crowd. I guess, I mean, I wonder, like, what his family thought, you know?
They must have been so proud.
If they were proud or if they were like, you idiot.
Could have survived if you had just run with everyone else.
Who knows? Maybe his home life was pretty bad and he was like, you know, this is an easy way. I'm just kidding. Oh, man.
Well, that was my research. That was good. What did you research this week?
So the other thing, so part of what was also interesting about this whole thing, you know, with all this plague, Phobo, what are they calling it? Phobos something? No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stuff is how they're using like a bio weapon, essentially. And so I was kind of looking into a little bit different bioweapons through history.
Ooh.
So this is from
stufftoblowyourmind.com,
and it's the 10 scariest bioweapons. Okay. Oh, but like Biotech did this bioweapon thing, and we also found out, guess who's running Biotech?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Ezra's mom.
I know. What do we think about that? I mean, we knew she was going to come in at some point.
That was a huge twist. And we knew she was with bad guys.
But I didn't know that she'd be directly involved in this particular... She almost killed her kid and probably killed her husband.
Yeah. And she didn't even know they were on the Carenza colony. Like, what are the odds that she picked that colony to invade and that's where her son and husband are?
Yeah, but also, how did she not do her due diligence?
That's true.
If your kid is missing and hiding from you, wouldn't you, like, double check before you destroyed a planet or a moon or whatever it was, a mine?
Think before you invade.
Things to keep in mind. Before releasing a bioweapon, make sure that you...
don't know anyone on
safely
it.
Put your kid
on the planet
somewhere. Advice for parents everywhere. But
yeah. And it's so weird that Katie sent her all the evidence.
I know. I can't decide if that was like cocky.
Like she compiled all the dossier.
Like I kind of feel like that wasn't the smartest thing to do.
She was showing off a little bit. But that's fine. She's allowed to. She just survived. She just saved everyone, so she can show off a little bit.
Yeah, and she's PO'd, so, you know. What if your boyfriend's mom destroyed your whole life? Or Chad's mom? That's like mother-in-law to the extreme. Can you... I'm just kidding.
That is like monster-in-law right there.
New movie.
I don't think I have to worry about that.
No, I'm not. Luckily, I won't have to either, but yeah.
So tell me about bioweapons.
Oh, right. Okay, so...
Don't catfish me,
in
Katie.
In history... Basically, we've had bioweapons as long as we've had people. Well, not quite, but so 1500 BC is like the first known use of bioweapons where the Hittites of Asia Minor sent plague victims into enemy lands. So that was kind of like the first time. Ooh. But like throughout a lot of history, people would catapult diseased corpses into fortresses and they would poison wells. Mm-hmm. And you've heard about the disease smallpox blankets and stuff like that, right?
Yep, sure.
I've also heard, or some of these stories we're talking about, they would drop diseased fleas places. But
oh, like plague fleas?
Yeah. But this website,
God, so
also, it was kind of talking about which ones we should be afraid of, like what their threat is now. So like one of the first ones is smallpox, and it's still classified by the CDC as a Category A biological weapon because it has a high mortality rate and it can be transmitted through the air. So
how many people get smallpox though every year?
So there was like a huge effort by the World Health Organization back in the 60s and 70s, I think, or 1967, they tried to use mass vaccinations to eradicate smallpox. And in 1977, the last naturally occurring case of smallpox happened. But there's still a bunch of labs like around the world that have the, you know, the stuff that you can...
The virus. Like the live virus. Oof.
So...
That's so scary. Because what if it mutates? That's the thing. Like, I'm always so nervous that we're all going to be wiped out by a virus that just mutates so fast we can't keep up with it.
Yeah.
Like...
Because that's what happened.
Like, it's going to happen like in the
even if you have some way to protect yourself, if you don't get rid of all of it, then viruses are are like changing so fast. Whatever does survive is going to be what reproduces, and it's going to be even harder to get rid of, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's like a
superbug.
Lot of different. So anthrax, you know, people talked about a lot back in, what was it, 2001, when stamps or whatever showed up with anthrax on them. So most of the time, anthrax is transmitted through skin contact with spores, but its most deadly form is when it's inhaled. So it's hard to catch and it's hard to transmit. And usually like, people who like work in health departments, veterinarians who work with animals and military personnel will undergo vaccinations. But for the most part, we don't get vaccinated for that. Mm-hmm. That's another, when you're like rating these, I guess, how widespread a vaccination is would like affect how dangerous it is. So obviously if we don't have a lot of people who are vaccinated, so it would be more dangerous if it started spreading around. Does that make sense?
Right.
It would catch and spread.
But so since we're not vaccinated against anthrax, that could be really deadly. But also because there's not a lot of occurrences of it, that's why we're not all vaccinated against it. Is that right?
Yeah. And it doesn't seem like it's super contagious, or like the deadly one is the inhalation one, but it seems like it's hard. I probably should have, you know me, I like do just enough to like scare tactics.
Well, you were in the ER this week. Yeah. So I'm surprised you wanted to even research it.
Well, I wanted to research things I didn't have.
Could have asked your doctor.
Or like double check that they didn't get it wrong. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, they're still not exactly sure what's wrong with me, but I'm pretty sure it's not anthrax.
It's not the black plague.
Yeah, it's not. So another thing, this is also kind of scary when you're talking about what would actually be a threat for real going forward, because these are all kind of like, I meant to look up stories about the past, more flea blanket stuff or whatever, but instead this was the stuff that could actually, like, we should be scared of. So there's these chimera viruses now. So, or the at least the idea of it. So, you know, we talked about chimera when we did Daughter of Smoke and Bone. Is that it? Sometimes when we have all these and titles, I like forget what the two things that go together are. But anyway, so that's, you know, like different pieces of animals and Greek and Roman mythology stuff. But so now they're talking about viruses essentially that are made in a lab that take stuff from multiple other viruses, like super viruses kind of.
So it would be a virus kind of spliced together and you'd have all the symptoms of both viruses.
Yeah, or you'd, you know, get something that like spread really easily and then something else that's like has a high mortality rate or something. I mean, you know, like combining things like that. That was kind of...
What's an example of one?
I'm trying to find one. So like one example, so I guess in the 1980s, the Soviet Union had a project, a chimera project, where they were looking at combining smallpox and Ebola.
Ooh.
But they're also talking about like some of this stuff is also... We've learned more about genetic science in general. So I guess there's also this chimera that combines the common cold with polio, but it may help cure cancer or something. Like, so like, just because like we don't, you know, we're still like learning how all this stuff works. So some of this stuff is like actually potentially good, but also makes me nervous because who knows what you're gonna get.
Yeah. Anything with polio makes me nervous.
Yeah.
Nothing good can come out of that, I don't think.
Yeah.
That's interesting though.
So I mean it was kind of scary but kind of interesting, and also just to think about like the different things that affect how dangerous something would be. Like how quickly it spread is one of the main things. If we have a way to treat it, or if a vaccine exists, how widespread the vaccine is, how effective it is, like the mortality rate and stuff like that can all impact all that stuff. So it was kind of scary, but I'm curious to see how this virus, even though it seems like maybe no one who is infected is still alive at this point, but I find that an unlikely total solution, so we'll see.
And so it's scary because I'm just worried about it spreading, and I'm worried about other people getting their hands on it, because wasn't one of the reasons Aiden gave for bombing the Copernicus was because he didn't want the contagion to spread, but he also didn't want the ship to get back to what's the name of the ship where Katie's dad might be?
Oh yeah, Heimdall or something, right?
Yeah, the Heimdall. He was worried that if it got back, that people could have access to the illness or the virus and use it as a weapon.
Yeah, so that to was keep like weaponizing it.
One reason he gave.
And I mean, okay, I have another quick question, because I feel like on the Copernicus, this disease was spreading, but like not super crazy fast, because there were a lot of people. Like, I feel like when Katie was all alone on this
ship. I felt like it was spreading fast.
I mean, it was, but when Katie was all alone on the ship, it was like everyone was instantly impacted and like extremely crazy. Like they didn't like, it didn't take days to set in, or do you feel like that at all? That it felt, it happened like extremely fast, like it might be morphing already and being more affected, or, you know, like.
Yeah, I think it keeps mutating. Yeah. And that's why it's spreading so fast.
Yeah, so it also could be, who knows, hit, like, maybe some of the other people who got off the ship, like, maybe there is something, I don't know. I'm not convinced that we're free of it.
Well, I mean, we have that scene with Cirabol, who, she is kind of intercepting that escape pod that came from Alexander, and Mikal, I think was his name, he was, like, the person who was manning the pod, and she was like, listen, if one person shows any signs of contagion, you need to tell me, and he does, and then she purges the entire pod. Like, she flushes them through the airlock.
Yeah.
So it's like,
it's essentially the same thing.
Like, that was,
yeah, Aiden did, but on a different scale.
Yeah, which is, like, so funny, because I, at the end, I kind of felt bad for thinking bad things about Aiden, because I actually really liked him at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked, I don't know, I just, I was thinking too, because, like, he always says that he's programmed to make hard decisions without letting emotions get in the way, but then Sierra kind of does the exact same thing. Like, she made a really hard decision without letting her emotions, you know, come into play and think, like, oh my god, I'm killing all these people, some of whom aren't infected yet.
Yeah.
And so, it reminded me of, like,
she still jumped the gun a little bit. The guy, like, had a cough.
Yeah. She did. But, I don't know, it was just, like, when we were talking about Aiden and, you know, he's projecting certain emotions, but he had a moment where he was talking to Katie and he was like, just because I'm programmed to behave in certain ways doesn't make it less real, because he was like, your mother was programmed to love you the moment you were born.
I did like that analogy, because it's
true. And I thought that was such an interesting comparison. Yeah.
But,
like, as humans, we're totally hardwired to do certain things, and we have certain, you know, survival instincts, and I like when he was just like, just because it's programmed in me doesn't mean it's not genuine.
I still think Aiden's just, like, kind of a little bit of a sociopath. Like, emotions don't affect him as much, but, like, a human could be, like, a very similar way. Or, again, these are all hard decisions, so there isn't, like, a clear right answer. Like, it wouldn't necessarily be a good thing to just let everyone on the Copernicus live and possibly infect the rest of the ship, or get back and share the bioweapon, or, it seems really careless and was probably handled poorly, but ultimately it might have still been the right decision when you think about it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I hope he comes back. I just love his banter.
I think he will. I think he's on the little, I mean, she implied.
He's on the little chip.
She implied that he was growing, or needed more space, didn't she?
Yeah.
I also like that idea.
I just love their banter back and forth when she's like, he's like, oh, the power systems are through that door. And Katie's like, oh, you mean the door labeled power systems?
Yeah.
Thanks.
That stuff is good.
I want more of that.
Yeah. I am excited as well. Cool.
So, okay. Tell me what your favorite scene was.
Oh, okay. So honestly, zombie-like people kind of freaked me out even just reading it. So even though I think some of the coolest scenes would be, like, half the stuff that was happening at the end, I, like, don't know that I actually want to see that on the screen. It was, like, freaking me out.
Yeah.
But I think...
It was very scary.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious, like, how you would do this as a movie and still kind of keep the way the story is told true. Like, you could tell the story, but how do you, like, be kind of true to the book and the way it's, like, a bunch of different documents and videos and transcripts and stuff? Like, I think that could just be kind of interesting to see how that plays out, but...
That's a good question. I agree.
But I don't know. I mean, I just, like, seeing the space stuff. Like, I feel like they're maybe just, like, the final nuclear war.
Oh, yeah. When she has to, like, control the missiles manually because she can't get the auto system to run. And...
Yeah, it felt like a kind of video game, but, like, really, really high stakes. But, like, yeah.
I like when she was spacewalking.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what that's called? When she goes, like, outside the ship and she's, like, walking along the ship to escape the infected people. I really liked that. I liked seeing the control center of Alexander when it looks like it's just, like, a sphere of water and it can create wormholes. Like, I want to see what that looks like.
Yeah, but then that's when they sneak up on her and, like, shoot her silently because there's no sound. That part was, like, one of the creepy parts to me.
Oh, that's true.
But, I mean, no, but it would be cool. I think it would be just, like, being in space in general. Like, I also think... some of those clips when she's, like, you know, breaking into different rooms and, like, going up, it, like, some of that stuff just...
Oh, the surveillance camera.
Just, like, seeing how the ship works a little bit could be kind of interesting, too. Or even, no, you know what? I changed my mind. The first part, I think, would be kind of cool. Seeing when they're just, like, on this planet trying to figure out what's going on and they're, like, being attacked and everything's new and, like, seeing them get on the ship. Yeah, the invasion could be kind of exciting.
I think it would be cool to see when the Copernicus explodes, because I loved that scene. I think Ezra's observing it, and he was just in awe because he just sees this entire ship explode without any sound.
Yeah.
Like, it just explodes in total silence because the sound doesn't carry. And I think, like, that visual combined with no sound would be really, really impressive to see on screen.
Yeah. So should we talk about the next book yet? Are we...
Yes.
I mean, I'm ready to go start reading again. I'm, like, really into it.
I know, me too. I'm so excited to find out what happens next. Okay, so tell us about Gemina, which is the second book in the series. Yes.
Okay, so I'll read the inside flap. Moving to a space station at the edge of the galaxy was always going to be the death of Hannah's social life. Nobody said it might actually get her killed. I wonder where she moved from.
I know.
The saga that began with the breakout bestseller Illuminae continues on board the space station Heimdall, where two new characters will confront the next wave of Bitech's assault. Hannah is the station captain's pampered daughter, Nick, the reluctant member of a notorious crime family. And while they are struggling with the realities of life aboard the galaxy's most boring space station, little do they know that Katie Grant and the Hypatia are headed right toward Heimdall, carrying news of the Carenza invasion. When an elite Bitech team invades the station, Hannah and Nick are thrown together to defend their home. But alien predators are picking off the crew one by one. That's what it says. And a malfunction.
Oh, I'm so excited.
And the station's wormhole means the space-time continuum may be ripped in two before dinner. Soon, Hannah and Nick aren't just fighting for their own survival. The fate of everyone on the Hypatia and possibly in the known universe is in their hands. But relax. They've totally got this. They hope.
Oh my god. I'm so excited for Alien Predators.
The stakes are definitely jumping even higher, it sounds like. And we've just got new high school age kids in a potential new complicated romantic situation. What do you think?
It sounds like it's essentially another Katie and Ezra story, but with just different characters.
Yeah, except they weren't dating to start with, and one's from a notorious crime family and one's a pampered captain's daughter. It's gonna be fun. Ooh, and it says, featuring guest journal illustrations by best-selling author Marie Lu.
Oh, we love her.
Yeah. So I guess she drew stuff in here.
I can't wait to see her illustrations. Yeah. That'll be so awesome. I can't wait to research aliens next week.
I am curious that, like, I mean, they do mention Katie and stuff, but I wonder, like, how much we'll see of her, or if this will be, like, related, but kind of a whole new, it sounds like two new characters, but, you know, how much.
Oh, I hope we see
her. I know.
Her.
I'm not done with her yet. Yeah. Okay, and here, you're going to love this. Do you want to hear where we're going to read up to?
Oh, yes, because I don't have the book, so I have no idea where we're reading to.
So this is, it's a mostly black page that looks like a, like the back of a camera or something. And it just says, every camera dies as the room explodes.
Oh my god.
So read up to there.
It's going to be another cliffhanger.
Yeah. And then we're definitely have to record because we're going to want to keep reading, I'm sure.
Read until your room explodes.
Every camera dies as the room explodes.
Oh my god. I cannot wait.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. We gotta get
ready. So before we go read, you have to tell me a joke.
Okay. What do you call two monkeys that share an Amazon account?
I don't know. I like that.
Prime mates.
Laughter down so low. That was so funny. I can't wait to text that to my cousin's fiance. Two monkeys sharing an account. Yeah. Like, did you change the password again?
I kind of feel sometimes like James and I sharing an Amazon account would be very similar to two monkeys sharing an Amazon account, actually.
Yeah, same here.
Okay, so let's get reading.
Okay.
Up until every camera dies and the room explodes.
We should also say, because we forgot last time we were recording, that it was our 50th episode anniversary.
Oh, yeah.
And we both completely forgot.
Yeah. Time flies. I can't believe we've done 50 already.
Happy 50th.
You too.
It's amazing.
What is the 50th anniversary? How do you celebrate that? Do you know?
Oh, gosh. I have no idea. I looked up which one was books, and it's the 47th, so we missed that one. But then I didn't write down what 50 was. I think it's... Is it... I don't know. It's probably some jewel.
Can we pretend it's YA books? Let's just pretend that.
Every anniversary can be YA books. Or just, you know, whatever related to thing it actually is, just tie it into a book some way. Okay. Ruby, it'll be a book. Yeah. Diamond, it'll
I'm just going to tell James up front, like, yeah, just get me a book related to the theme of the anniversary, and you'll be set for life.
We're easy to please.
Cool, cool.
Okay.
Anything else?
Do you want to tell people how to get in touch?
Yes. If you would like to reach out to us, we would love it. We literally, like, text each other and we're like, yay, someone talked to us. But for real.
It makes our day.
Email us at mnktalkya@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram. Look at some of our pictures. Find us on Facebook, mnktalkya, on both of those as well. And we'd love to...
And send us...
Yeah, go.
Send us dad jokes. Send us book recommendations. And this week... since Aiden really upped his game with the illustrations, now you have to send us pictures of our faces made out of words. Yeah,
since we didn't get any roses, we assumed that was beneath everyone's ability and you really need a harder challenge.
I would actually be so weirded out if that happened.
It would depend on who it was. I would still be weirded out, but like if it was from someone who doesn't actually know us and it was like really good of our faces, exactly. I'd be pretty weirded out. If it was like from my sister, I'd be like, you need a job.
I can handle that. Okay, well, let's get reading.
All right. Yep, bye, bookworms.
And go get a library card. M&K Talk YA is produced and edited by Marissa Snyder and Katie Bradford. Original music composition by Timothy Milkey. Logo design by Marissa Snyder. For updates and extras, visit mnktalkya.com or follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And if you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. We would like to thank James Tobias, Chad Snyder, Meredith Kelfie, and Michael Howard for all of their support. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.